Chapter 19.
My mother and the kids and I are having dinner that evening.
Aren't you going to eat your peas, Alex?
Mom, I'm an adult now. It's my option whether or not to eat my peas. Sorry, I'm a little depressed tonight.
What's wrong, Dad?
Well, it's kind of complicated. Let's just finish dinner. I've got to leave for the airport in a few minutes.
Are you going away?
No, I'm just going to pick up somebody.
Is it Mommy?
No, not Mommy. I wish it could be.
Alex, tell your children what's bothering you. It affects them, too.
I look at the kids and realize my mother's right. We found out we've got some problems at the plant which we might not be able to solve.
What about the man you called? Can't you talk to him?
You mean Jonah? That's who I'm picking up at the airport. But I'm not sure even Jonah's help will do any good.
You mean all that stuff we learned about on the hike about Herbie setting the speed for the whole troop and all that? None of that was true?
Of course it's still true, Dave. The problem is, we discovered we've got two Herbies at the plant, and they're right where we don't want them. It would be as if we couldn't rearrange the boys on the trail, and Herbie had a twin brother, and now they're both stuck in the middle of the line. They're holding everything up. We can't move them. We've got piles and piles of inventory stacked in front of them. I don't know what we can do.
Well, if they can't do the work, you'll just have to let them go.
It's not people. It's equipment. We can't fire machines. And anyway, what they do is essential. We couldn't produce most of our products without these two operations.
So why don't you make them go faster?
Sure, Dad. Remember what happened on the hike when you took Herbie's pack off him? Maybe you could do something kind of like that in the plant.
Yeah, but it's not quite that simple.
Alex, I know you'll do the best you can. If you've got these two slowpokes holding everything up, you'll just have to keep after them and make sure they don't waste any more time.
Yeah. Well, I've got to run. Don't wait up for me. I'll see you in the morning. Waiting at the gate, I watched Jonah's plane taxi up to the terminal. I talked to him in Boston this afternoon just before he was leaving for Los Angeles. I told him I wanted to thank him for his advice, but that the situation at the plant was impossible as far as we could see.
Alex, how do you know it's impossible?
We've only got 2 months left before my boss goes to the board of directors with his recommendation. If we had more time, maybe we could do something, but with only 2 months...
2 months is still enough time to show an improvement. But you have to learn how to run your plant by its constraints.
Jonah, we've analyzed the situation thoroughly.
Alex, there are two ways that the ideas I'm giving you won't work. One is, if there isn't any demand for the products your plant makes.
No, we have a demand, although it's shrinking as our prices go up and service deteriorates. But we still have a sizable backlog of orders.
I also can't help you if you are determined not to change. Have you made up your mind to do nothing and let the plant close?
It's not that we want to give up. It's that we don't see any other possibilities.
Okay, then. Have you tried to take some of the load off the bottlenecks by using other resources?
You mean offloading? We can't. There are only two resources of their type in the plant.
All right. One more question. Does Barrington have an airport?
And so here he is tonight, walking out of gate 2. He changed his flight to Los Angeles to make a stop here for the evening. I walk up to him and shake his hand. How was your flight?
Have you ever spent time in a sardine can? I shouldn't complain. I'm still breathing.
Well, thanks for coming. I appreciate you changing your plans, although I'm still not sure you can help us.
Alex, having a bottleneck...
Two bottlenecks.
Having two bottlenecks doesn't mean you can't make money. Quite the contrary, in fact. Most manufacturing plants do not have bottlenecks. They have enormous excess capacity. But they should have them. One on every part they make.
He reads the puzzled look on my face.
You don't understand, but you will. Now I want you to give me as much background on your plant as you can.
All the way from the airport, I talk nonstop about our predicament. When we reach the plant, I park the Buick in front of the offices. Waiting for us inside are Bob, Lou, Stacy, and Ralph. They're standing around the vacant receptionist desk. Everyone is cordial. But as I make the introductions, I can tell the staff is waiting to see if this Jonah guy, who bears no resemblance to any consultant they've ever seen walk through the door, really knows what he's doing. Jonah stands in front of them and begins to pace as he talks.
Alex called me today because you perceive a problem with the bottlenecks you've discovered in your plant. Actually, you are experiencing a combination of several problems. But first things first. From what Alex has told me, your most immediate need is to increase throughput and improve your cash flow. Am I right?
That sure would be a big help.
Yeah.
How do you think we might be able to do that?
Your bottlenecks are not maintaining a flow sufficient to meet demand and make money. So there's only one thing to do. We have to find more capacity.
But we don't have the money for more capacity.
Or the time to install it.
I'm not talking about more capacity from one end of the plant to the other. To increase the capacity of the plant is to increase the capacity of only the bottlenecks.
You mean make them into non-bottlenecks?
No, absolutely not. The bottlenecks stay bottlenecks. What we must do is find enough capacity for the bottlenecks to become more equal to demand.
Where are we going to find it? You mean it's just laying around out there?
In effect, yes. If you are like most manufacturers, you will have capacity that is hidden from you because some of your thinking is incorrect. And I suggest that first of all we go into your plant and see for ourselves exactly how you are managing your two bottlenecks.
Why not? After all, no one visits this plant and escapes without a tour. The six of us put on the safety glasses and hats and go into the plant. Jonah and I head the column as we walk through the double doors into the orange light. It's about halfway into second shift now, and somewhat quieter than it is on day turn. That's good, because it lets us hear each other better when we talk. I point out various stages of production to Jonah as we walk. I notice Jonah's eyes measuring the stacks of inventory piled everywhere. I try to hurry us along. This is our NCX-10 NC machine.
And this is your bottleneck, correct?
One of them.
Can you tell me why it isn't working right now?
Indeed, the NCX-10 is stopped at the moment. Well, good question. Bob, why isn't the NCX-10 running? Bob glances at his watch.
Well, probably because the setup people went on break about 10 minutes ago. They should be back in about 20 minutes.
There is a clause in our union contract which stipulates that there must be a half-hour break after every 4 hours of work.
But why should they take their break now instead of when the machine is running?
Well, because it was 8 o'clock and it's...
Oh, wait a minute. On any non-bottleneck machine in your plant, no problem. Because after all, some percentage of a non-bottleneck's time should be idle. So who cares when those people take their breaks? It's no big deal. But on a bottleneck, it's exactly the opposite. You have on this machine only so many hours available for production. What is it, 600, 700 hours?
It's around 585 hours a month.
Whatever is available, the demand is even greater. If you lose one of those hours, or even half of it, you have lost it forever. You cannot recover it someplace else in the system. Your throughput for the entire plant will be lower by whatever amount the bottleneck produces in that time. And that makes an enormously expensive lunch break.
But we have a union to deal with.
So talk to them. They have a stake in this plant. They're not stupid, but you have to make them understand.
Yeah, I'm thinking. That's easier said than done. On the other hand, Jonah is walking around the NCX-10 now, but he's not just looking at it alone. He's looking at other equipment in the plant. He comes back to us.
You've told me this is the only machine of its type in the plant. But this is a relatively new machine. Where are the older machines that this one replaced? Do you still have those?
Well, some of them we do. Some of them we got rid of. They were practically antiques.
Do you have at least one of each type of the older machines necessary to do what this X-whatever-it-is machine does?
Excuse me, but you're not actually suggesting we use that old equipment, are you?
If it's still operational, then yes, I might suggest it.
Lou's eyes blink.
Well, I'm not sure what that would do to our cost profile, but I have to tell you that those old machines are going to be much more expensive to operate.
We'll deal with that directly. First, I just want to know if you have the machines or not.
Bob?
Well, sorry to disappoint you all, but we got rid of an entire class of machine that we'd need to supplement the NCX-10.
Why did we go to a dumb thing like that?
We needed the floor space for that new pen to hold inventory.
Oh, yeah, right.
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Moving right along to heat treat, we gather in front of the furnaces. The first thing Jonah does is look at the stacks of parts.
Are you sure all this inventory requires heat treat?
Oh, absolutely.
There are no alternatives in the processing ahead of this department that would prevent the need for heat treat on at least some of these parts?
We all look at each other. I guess we'd have to consult with engineering. Bob rolls his eyes. What's the matter?
Well, let's just say our friends in engineering aren't as responsive as they could be. They're not too happy about changing requirements. Their attitude is usually, do it this way because we said so.
I'm afraid he does have a point. Even if we can get them to cooperate, it might take a month of Sundays for them to approve it.
Okay, let me ask you this. Are there vendors in the area who can heat treat parts for you?
There are, but going outside would increase our cost per part.
The expression on Jonah's face says he's getting a little bored with this stonewalling. He points at the mountains of parts.
How much money is represented in that pile?
I don't know, maybe $10,000 or $15,000 in parts.
No, it isn't thousands of dollars, not if this is a bottleneck. Think again, it's considerably more.
I can go dig up the records if you like, but the cost won't be much more than what Lou said. At the most, I guess we've got about $20,000 in material.
No, no, I'm not just talking about the cost of materials. How many products are you going to sell to customers as soon as you can process this entire pile?
The staff and I talk among ourselves for a moment.
Well, it's kind of hard to say.
We're not sure all the parts in that pile would translate into immediate sales.
Oh, really? You're making your bottlenecks work on parts that will not contribute to throughput?
Well, some of them become spare parts, so they go into finished goods inventory. Eventually, it becomes throughput.
Eventually, and meanwhile, how big did you say your backlog of overdue orders is?
I explained to him that sometimes we inflate the batch quantities to improve efficiency.
Tell me again how this improves your efficiency.
I feel myself starting to turn red with the memory of earlier conversations.
Okay, never mind that for now. Let's concern ourselves strictly with throughput. I'll put my question differently. How many products are you unable to ship because you are missing the parts in that pile?
That's easier to determine because we know what our backlog is. I tell them how many millions we've got in backlog and about what percent of that is held up on account of bottleneck parts.
And if you could finish the parts in that pile, you could assemble and ship the product?
Sure, no problem.
And what is the selling price of each unit?
About $1,000 a unit on the average, although it varies, of course.
Then we are not dealing with $10,000 or $15,000 or even $20,000 here. Because you are dealing with how many parts in that pile?
Perhaps 1,000.
And each part means you can ship a product?
Generally, yes.
And each product shipped means $1,000. 1,000 units times $1,000 is how much money?
$1,000,000.
Holy.
On one condition, that you can get these parts in and out of heat treat and shipped as a finished product before your customers get tired of waiting and go elsewhere.
He looks at us, his eyes shifting from face to face.
Can you afford to rule out any possibility, especially one that is as easy to invoke as a change in policy? By the way, I'll tell you more about how to look at the costs in a moment. But one more thing. I want to know where you do quality inspection on bottleneck parts.
Most inspection is done prior to final assembly.
Show me.
So we go to an area where we do quality inspections. Jonah asks about bottleneck parts that we reject. Immediately, Bob points to a pallet stacked with shiny steel parts. On top of them is a pink sheet of paper, which indicates rejection by quality control, or QC as it's known. Bob picks up the job jacket and reads the forms inside.
I'm not sure what's wrong with these, but they must be defective for some reason.
Did these parts come through a bottleneck?
Yeah, they did.
Do you realize what the rejection by QC has done to you?
It means we have to scrap about 100 parts.
No, think again. These are bottleneck parts.
It dawns on me what he's getting at. We lost time on the bottleneck.
Exactly right. And what does lost time on a bottleneck mean? It means you have lost throughput.
But you're not saying we should ignore quality, are you?
Absolutely not. You can't make money for long without a quality product. But I am suggesting you use quality control in a different way.
You mean we should put QC in front of the bottlenecks?
Very perceptive of you. Make sure the bottleneck works only on good parts by weeding out the ones that are defective. If you scrap a part before it reaches the bottleneck, all you have lost is a scrap part. But if you scrap the part after it's past the bottleneck, you have lost time that cannot be recovered.
Suppose we get substandard quality downstream from the bottleneck.
That's another aspect of the same idea. Be sure the process controls on bottleneck parts are very good, so these parts don't become defective in later processing. Are you with me?
Just one question. Where do we get the inspectors?
What's wrong with shifting the ones you already have to the bottlenecks?
That's something we can think about.
Good. Let's go back to the offices.
We go back to the office building and meet in the conference room.
I want to be absolutely sure you understand the importance of the bottlenecks. Every time a bottleneck finishes a part, you are making it possible to ship a finished product. And how much does that mean to you in sales?
It averages around $1,000 a unit.
And you're worried about spending a dollar or two at the bottlenecks to make them more productive? First of all, what do you think the cost of, let's say, the X machine is for 1 hour?
That's well established. It costs us $32.50 per hour.
And heat rate?
That's $21 per hour.
Both of those amounts are incorrect.
But our cost data tell us that...
The numbers are wrong. Not because you have made a calculating error, but because the costs were determined as if these work centers existed in isolation. Let me explain. When I was a physicist, people would come to me from time to time with problems in mathematics they couldn't solve. They wanted me to check their numbers for them. But after a while, I learned not to waste my time checking the numbers, because the numbers were almost always right. However, if I checked the assumptions, they were almost always wrong.
Jonah pulls a cigar out of his pocket and lights it with a match.
That's what's going on here. You have calculated the cost of operating these two work centers according to standard accounting procedures without considering the fact that both are bottlenecks.
How does that change their costs?
What you have learned is that the capacity of the plant is equal to the capacity of its bottlenecks. Whatever the bottlenecks produce in an hour is the equivalent of what the plant produces in an hour. So... an hour lost at the bottleneck is an hour lost for the entire system.
Right, we're with you.
Then how much would it cost for this entire plant to be idle for 1 hour?
I really can't say, but it would be very expensive.
Tell me something. How much does it cost you to operate your plant each month?
Our total operating expense is around $1.6 million per month.
And let's just take the X machine as an example. How many hours a month did you say it's available for production?
About 585.
The actual cost of a bottleneck is the total expense of the system divided by the number of hours the bottleneck produces. What does this make it?
Lou takes out his calculator from his coat pocket and punches in the numbers.
That's $2,735. Now, wait a minute. Is that right?
Yes, it's right. If your bottlenecks are not working, you haven't just lost $32 or $21. The true cost is the cost of an hour of the entire system. And that's $2,700.
Lou is flabbergasted.
That puts a different perspective on it.
Of course it does. And with that in mind, how do we optimize the use of the bottlenecks? There are two principal themes on which you need to concentrate. First, make sure the bottleneck's time is not wasted. How is the time of a bottleneck wasted? One way is for it to be sitting idle during a lunch break. Another is for it to be processing parts which are already defective or which will become defective through a careless worker or poor process control. A third way to waste a bottleneck's time is to make it work on parts you don't need.
You mean spare parts?
I mean anything that isn't within the current demand. Because what happens when you build inventory now that you won't sell for months in the future? You are sacrificing present money for future money. The question is, Can your cash flow sustain it? In your case, absolutely not.
He's right.
Yeah.
Then make the bottlenecks work only on what will contribute to throughput today, not 9 months from now. That's one way to increase the capacity of the bottlenecks. The other way you increase bottleneck capacity is to take some of the load off the bottlenecks and give it to non-bottlenecks.
Yeah, but how do we do that?
That's why I was asking those questions when we were out in the plant. Do all the parts have to be processed by the bottleneck? If not, the ones which don't can be shifted to non-bottlenecks for processing. And the result is you gain capacity on your bottleneck. A second question. Do you have other machines to do the same process? If you have the machines, or if you have a vendor with the right equipment, you can offload from the bottleneck. And again, you gain capacity, which enables you to increase throughput.
I come into the kitchen for breakfast the next morning and sit down to a big steaming bowl of my mother's oatmeal, which I have hated ever since I was a kid. I'm staring at the oatmeal, and the oatmeal is staring back. When Grandma asks...
So how did everything go last night?
Well, actually, you and the kids were on the right track at dinner.
We were?
Yeah, we need to make the Herbies go faster. And last night, Jonah pointed out some ways to do that, so we learned a lot.
Well, now, isn't that good news?
She pours herself a cup of coffee and sits down at the table. It's quiet for a moment. Then I notice that Mom and the kids are eyeing each other. Something wrong?
Their mother called again last night while you were gone.
Julie has been calling the kids regularly since she left, but for whatever reason of her own, she still won't tell them where she is. I'm debating whether to hire a private detective to find out where she's hiding.
Sharon says she heard something when she was on the phone talking.
I look at Sharon.
You know that music Grandpa always listens to?
You mean Grandpa Barnett?
Uh-huh, you know, the music that puts you to sleep with the... What are they called?
Violins.
Right, the violins. Well, when Mom wasn't talking, I heard that on the phone last night.
I heard him, too.
Really? That's very interesting. Thank you both for noticing that. Maybe I'll give Grandma and Grandpa Barnett another call today. I finish my coffee and stand up.
Alex, you haven't even touched your oatmeal.
Sorry, I'm late for school. I wave to the kids and hurry to grab my briefcase.
Well, I'll just have to save it so you can eat it tomorrow.
Chapter 20.
Driving to the plant, I pass the motel where Jonah stayed last night. I know he's long gone. He had a 6:30 a.m. flight to catch. I offered to pick him up this morning and drive him to the airport, but lucky for me, he refused and said he'd take a cab. As soon as I get to the office, I tell Fran to set up a meeting with the staff. Meanwhile, I start to write down a list of the actions Jonah suggested last night, but Julie comes to mind and won't leave. I close my office door and sit down at my desk. I find the number for Julie's parents and dial it. The first day after Julie left, her parents called to ask me if I had heard anything. They haven't called back since. A day or two ago, I tried to get in touch with them to find out if they had heard anything. I called in the afternoon, and I talked to Julie's mother, Ada. She said she didn't know where Julie was. Even then, I didn't quite believe her.
Hello?
Hi, this is Alex. Let me talk to Julie.
Well... She isn't here.
Yes, she is. She is there, isn't she?
She doesn't want to talk to you.
How long, Ada? How long has she been there? Were you lying to me that Sunday night when I called?
No, we were not lying to you. We had no idea where she was. She was with her friend Jane for a few days.
Sure, and what about the other day when I called?
Julie simply asked me not to say where she was, and I shouldn't even be telling you now. She wants to be by herself for a while.
Ada... I need to speak with her.
She will not come to the phone.
How do you know until you've asked? The phone on Ada's end is put down on the table. Footsteps fade away and return a minute later.
She says she'll call you when she's ready.
What does that mean?
If you hadn't neglected her all these years, you wouldn't be in this situation.
Ada!
Goodbye.
I try calling back right away, but there's no answer. After a few minutes, I force my mind back to getting ready to talk to the staff. At 10 o'clock, the meeting starts in my office. I'd like to know what you think about what you heard last night. Lou, what was your reaction?
Well, I just couldn't believe what he was saying about an hour of a bottleneck. I went home last night and thought it over to see if it all made sense. And actually, we were wrong about a lost hour of a bottleneck costing $2,700.
We were?
Only 80% of our products flow through the bottlenecks. So the true cost ought to be 80% of our operating expense, and that comes to $2,188 an hour, not $2,735.
Oh, I suppose you're right.
Nevertheless, I have to admit it was quite an eyeful to look at the situation from that perspective.
I agree. What about the rest of you? I go from person to person around the office asking for reactions, and we're all pretty much in agreement. Even so, Bob seems hesitant about committing to some of the changes Jonah was talking about, and Ralph isn't sure yet where he fits in. But Stacy's a strong advocate.
I think it makes enough sense to risk the changes.
Although I'm nervous about anything that increases operating expense at this point in time, I agree with Stacy. As Jonah said, we may face a bigger risk just staying on the path we've been following.
Bob raises one of his meaty hands.
Okay, but some of what Jonah talked about will be easier and faster to make happen than the rest. Why don't we go ahead with the easier things right away and see what kind of effect they have while we're developing the others?
That sounds reasonable. What would you do first?
Well, I think I want to move the QC inspection points first to check parts going into the bottlenecks. The other QC measures will take a little time, but we can have an inspector checking pre-bottleneck parts in no time by the end of today, if you want.
Good. What about new rules for lunch breaks?
Yeah, we might have a squawk or two from the union.
No, I think they'll go along with it. Work out the details, and I'll talk to O'Donnell.
Okay.
Bob makes a note on the paper pad on his lap. I stand up and step around the desk to emphasize what I'm about to say. One of the questions Jonah raised last night really struck home for me. Why are we making the bottlenecks work on inventory that won't increase throughput? Bob looks at Stacy, and she looks back at him.
That's a good question.
Well, we made the decision.
I know we made the decision. Build inventory to maintain efficiencies. But our problem is not efficiencies. Our problem is our backlog of overdue orders, and it's very visible to our customers and to division management. We positively must do something to improve our due date performance, and Jonah has given us the insight on what that something has to be. Until now, we've expedited orders on the basis of who screamed the loudest. From now on, late orders should get first priority over the others. An order that's 2 weeks late gets priority over an order that's 1 week late, and so on.
We've tried that from time to time in the past.
Yes, but the key this time is we make sure the bottlenecks are processing parts for those late orders, according to the same priority.
That's the sane approach to the problem, Al. Now, how do we make it happen?
We have to find out which inventory en route to the bottlenecks is needed for late orders, and which is simply going to end up in a warehouse. So here's what we need to do. Ralph, I want you to make us a list of all the overdue orders. Have them ranked in priority, ranging from the most days overdue to the least days overdue. How soon can you have that for us?
Well, that in itself won't take very long. The problem is we've got the monthlies to run.
Nothing is more important to us right now than making the bottlenecks more productive. We need that list as soon as possible, because once you've got it, I want you to work with Stacy and her people in inventory control. Find out what parts still have to be processed by either of the bottlenecks to complete those orders. Stacy, after you know which parts are missing, get together with Bob and schedule the bottlenecks to start working on the parts for the latest order first, the next latest, and so on.
Sure.
What about the parts that don't go through either one of the bottlenecks?
I'm not going to worry about those at the moment. Let's work on the assumption that anything not needing to go through a bottleneck is either waiting in front of assembly already or will be by the time the bottleneck parts arrive. Everybody got it? Nothing else takes priority over this. We don't have time to take a step back and do some kind of headquarters number where everyone takes 6 months to think about it. We know what we have to do. Let's get it done.
Right.
Okay.
That evening, I'm driving along the interstate. Around sunset, I'm looking around at the rooftops of suburban houses to either side of the highway. A sign goes by which says I'm 2 miles from the exit to Forest Grove. Julie's parents live in Forest Grove. I take that exit. Neither the Barnetts nor Julie know I'm coming. I told my mother not to tell the kids. I simply hopped in the car after work and headed down here. I've had enough of this hide-and-seek game she's playing. From a four-lane highway, I turn onto a smooth blacktop street which winds through a quiet neighborhood. It's a nice neighborhood. The homes are unquestionably expensive, and the lawns, without exception, are immaculate. The streets are lined with trees, just getting the new leaves of spring. They are brilliant green in the golden setting sun. I see the house halfway down the street. It's the two-story brick colonial painted white. It has shutters. The shutters are made of aluminum and have no hinges. They are non-functional, but traditional. This is where Julie grew up. I park the Buick by the curb in front of the house. I look up the driveway, and sure enough, there's Julie's Accord in front of the garage. Before I have reached the front door, it opens. Ada Barnett is standing behind the screen. I see her hand reach down and click the screen door lock as I approach. Hello?
I told you she doesn't want to talk to you.
Will you just ask her, please? She is my wife.
If you want to talk to Julie, you can do it through her lawyer.
She starts to close the door. Ada, I am not leaving until I talk to your daughter.
If you don't leave, I will call the police to have you removed from our property.
Then I will wait in my car. You don't own the street. The door closes. I walk across the lawn and over the sidewalk and get in the Buick. I sit there and stare at the house. Every so often, I notice the curtains move behind the window glass of the Barnett house. After about 45 minutes, the sun has set, and I'm seriously wondering how long I can sit here when the front door opens again. Julie walks out. She's wearing jeans and sneakers and a sweater. The jeans and sneakers make her look young. She reminds me of a teenager meeting a boyfriend her parents disapprove of. She comes across the lawn, and I get out of the car. When she's about 10 feet away, she stops, as if she's worried about getting too close, where I might grab her, pull her into the car, and drive like the wind to my tent in the desert or something. We look each other over. I slide my hands into my pockets. So, how've you been?
If you want to know the truth, I've been rotten. How have you been?
Worried about you. Let's go for a ride.
No, I can't.
How about a walk, then?
Alex, just tell me what you want, okay?
I want to know why you're doing this.
Because I don't know if I want to be married to you anymore. Isn't that obvious?
Okay. Can't we talk about it? Come on, let's take that walk. Just once around the block, unless you want to give the neighbors lots to talk about. Julie looks around at the houses and realizes we're a spectacle. Awkwardly, she steps toward me. I hold out my hand. She doesn't take it, but we turn together and begin a stroll down the sidewalk. I wave to the Barnett house and note the flurry of a curtain. Julie and I walk 100 feet or so in the twilight before we say anything. Look, I'm sorry about what happened that weekend, but what else could I do? Davy expected
me to... It wasn't because you went on the hike with Davy. That was just the last straw. All of a sudden, I just couldn't stand it anymore. I had to get away.
Julie, why didn't you at least let me know where you were?
Listen, I went away from you so I could be alone.
So, do you want a divorce?
I don't know yet.
Well, when will you know?
Al, this has been a very mixed-up time for me. I don't know what to do. I can't decide anything. My mother tells me one thing, my father tells me something else. My friends tell me something else. Everyone except me knows what I should do.
You went off to be by yourself, to make a decision that's going to affect both of us as well as our kids. And you're listening to everyone except the three other people whose lives are going to be screwed up if you don't come back.
This is something I need to figure out on my own, away from the pressures of you three.
All I'm suggesting is that we talk about what's bothering you.
Al, we've been over it a million times already.
Okay, look, just tell me this. Are you having an affair?
I think I've gone far enough with you.
I stand there for a moment as she turns and heads back toward her parents' house. I catch up with her. Well, are you or aren't you?
Of course I'm not having an affair. Do you think I'd be staying with my parents if I were having an affair?
A man who is walking his dog turns and stares at us. Julie and I stride past him in stiff silence. I just had to know, that's all.
If you think I'd leave my children just to go have a fling with some stranger, you have no understanding of who I am.
Julie, I'm sorry. That kind of thing sometimes happens, and I just needed to make sure of what's going on.
Al, I've been unhappy for a long time, and I'll tell you something. I feel guilty about it. I feel as though I don't have a right to be unhappy. I just know I am.
With irritation, I see we're back in front of her parents' house. The walk was too short. Ada is standing in plain view at the window. Julie and I stop. I lean against the rear fender of the Buick. Why don't you pack your things and come home with me?
No, I'm not ready to do that.
Okay, look. The choice is this. You stay away and we get a divorce. Or we get back together and struggle to make the marriage work. The longer you stay away, the more we're going to drift apart from each other and toward a divorce. And if we get a divorce, you know what's going to happen. We've seen it happen over and over to our friends. Do you really want that? Come on. Come home. I promise we can make it better.
I can't, Al. I've heard too many promises before.
Then you want a divorce.
I told you I don't know.
Okay. I can't make up your mind for you. Maybe it is your decision. All I can say is I want you back. I'm sure that's what the kids want, too. Give me a call when you know what you want.
That was exactly what I planned to do, Al.
I get into the Buick and start the engine. Rolling down the window, I look up at her as she stands on the sidewalk next to the car. You know, I do happen to love you. This finally melts her. She comes to the car and leans down. Reaching through the window, I take her hand for a moment. She kisses me. Then, without a word, she stands up and walks away. Halfway across the lawn, she breaks into a run. I watch her until she's disappeared through the door. Then I shake my head, put the car into gear, and drive away.
Chapter 21.
I'm home by 10 o'clock that night. Depressed, but home. Rummaging through the refrigerator, I attempt to find dinner, but have to settle for cold spaghetti and some leftover peas. Washing it down with some leftover vodka, I dine in dejection. I'm wondering while I'm eating what I'm going to do if Julie doesn't come back. If I don't have a wife, do I start to date women again? Where would I meet them? I have a sudden vision of myself standing in the bar of the Barrington Holiday Inn, attempting to be sexy while asking strange females, "What's your sign?" Is that my fate? My God. And anyway, do lines like that even work these days? Did they ever? I must know somebody to go out with. For a while, I sit there thinking of all the available women I know. Who would go out with me? Who would I want to go out with? It doesn't take long to exhaust the list. Then one woman comes to mind. Getting up from my chair, I go to the phone and spend about 5 minutes staring at it. Should I? Nervously, I dial the number. I hang up before it rings. I stare at the phone some more. Oh, what the hell? All she can do is say no, right? I dial the number again. It rings about 10 times before anybody answers.
Hello?
It's her father. May I speak to Julie, please?
Just a minute.
Hello?
Hi. It's me.
Al?
Yeah, listen. I know it's late, but I just want to ask you something.
If it has to be with getting a divorce or coming home...
No. I was just wondering if, while you're making up your mind, there would be any harm in us seeing each other once in a while.
Well, I guess not.
Good. What are you doing Saturday night? There's a moment of silence as the smile forms on her face.
Are you asking me for a date?
Yeah, I am. So, would you like to go out with me?
Yes, I'd like that a lot.
Great. How about I see you at 7:30?
I'll be ready.
The next morning in the conference room, we've got the two supervisors of the bottlenecks with us. By us, I mean Stacy, Bob, Ralph, and me. Ted Spencer is the supervisor responsible for the heat treat furnaces. He's an older guy with hair that looks like steel wool and a body like a steel file. We've got him and Mario DeMonte, a supervisor of the machining center with the NCX-10. Mario is as old as Ted, but plumper. Stacy and Ralph both have red eyes. Before we sat down, they told me about the work that went into this morning's meeting. Getting the list of overdue orders was easy. The computer listed them and sorted them according to lateness. Nothing to it, didn't even take an hour. But then they had to go over the bills of material for each of the orders and find out which parts are done by the bottlenecks. And they had to establish whether there was inventory to make those parts. That took most of the night. Stacy told me this morning this was the first time she really appreciated the existence of the computer. We all have our own photocopies of a handwritten list Ralph has had prepared. Listed in the printout is a grand total of 67 records, our total backlog of overdue orders. They have been sorted from most days past due to least days. The worst one, at the top of the list, is an order that is 58 days beyond the delivery date promised by marketing. The best are one day late. There are three of those orders.
We did some checking, and about 90% of the current overdues have parts that flow through one or both of the bottleneck operations. Of those, about 85% are held up at assembly because we're waiting for those parts to arrive before we can build and ship.
So it's obvious those parts get first priority.
We went ahead and made a list for both heat treat and the NCX-10 as to which parts they each have to process and in what order. Again, the same sequence of latest orders to least late. In about a week, we can generate the list by computer and stop burning the midnight oil.
Fantastic, Ralph. I think both you and Stacy have done a super job. Now, all you gentlemen have to do is have your foreman start at the top of the list and work their way down.
That sounds easy enough. I think we can handle that. You know, we may have to go track some of these down.
So, you'll have to do some digging through the inventory. What's the problem?
No problem. You just want us to do what's on this list.
Yep.
Right?
It's that simple. And I don't want to see either of you working on something not on that list. If the expediters give you any problem, tell them to come see me. And be sure you stick to the sequence we've given you.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Stacy, you do understand how important it is for the expediters not to interfere with this priority list, don't you?
Okay, but you have to promise me you won't change it because of pressure from marketing.
You have my word of honor. In all seriousness, I hope you two guys know that heat treat and the NCX-10 are the most important processes in the whole plant. How well you manage those two could very well determine whether this plant has a future.
We'll do our best.
I can assure you that they will.
Right after that meeting, I go down the hall to personnel relations for a meeting with Mike O'Donnell, our union local president. When I walk in, my personnel manager, Scott Dolan, is gripping the armrests of his chair with white knuckles while O'Donnell is talking at the top of his voice. What's the problem here?
You know very well what the problem is, your new lunch rules and heat treat and NC machining. They're in violation of the contract. I refer you to Section 7, Paragraph 4.
Okay, all right. Wait a minute, Mike. It's time we gave the union an update on the situation at the plant. For the rest of the morning, I describe for him the situation the plant is in. Then I tell him some of what we've discovered and explain why the changes are necessary. You understand, don't you, that it's probably only going to affect about 20 people at the most.
Yeah, look, I appreciate you trying to explain all this, but we got a contract. Now, if we look the other way in one thing, what's to say you won't start changing whatever else you don't like?
Mike, in all honesty, I can't tell you that down the road a ways we won't need to make other changes. But we're ultimately talking about jobs. I'm not asking for cuts in wages or concessions on benefits, but I am asking for flexibility. We have to make the leeway necessary to make changes that will allow the plant to make money. Or, very simply, there may not be a plant in a few months.
Sounds like scare tactics to me.
Mike, all I can say is if you want to wait a couple of months to see if I'm just trying to scare everyone, it'll be too late.
I'll have to think about it. Talk it over and all that. We'll get back to you.
By early afternoon, I can't stand it anymore. I'm anxious to find out how the new priority system is working. I try calling Bob Donovan, but he's out in the plant. So I decide to go have a look for myself. The first place I check is the NCX-10. But when I get to the machine, there's nobody to ask. Being an automated machine, it runs a lot of the time with nobody tending it. The problem is that when I walk up, the damn thing is just sitting there. It isn't running and nobody's doing a setup. I get mad. I go find Mario. Why the hell isn't that machine working? He checks with the foreman. Finally, he walks back to me.
We don't got the materials.
What do you mean you don't have materials? What do you call these stacks of steel everywhere?
But you told us to work according to what's on the list.
You mean you finished all the late parts?
No. They did the first two batches of the parts. Then when we got the third part on the list, they looked all around and couldn't find the materials for it in the queue. So we're shut down until they turn up.
I'm ready to strangle him.
Well, that's what you want us to do, right? You wanted us to do only what was on the list and in the same order as listed, didn't you? I mean, isn't that what you said?
Yes, that is what I said. But didn't it occur to you that if you couldn't do one item on the list, you should go on to the next? Well, where the hell are the materials you need?
I don't know. I don't have no idea. They could have been in a half a dozen places. But I think Bob Donovan might have somebody looking for them already.
Okay, look. You have the setup people get this machine ready for whatever is the next part on that list for which you do have the materials. And keep this hunk of junk running.
Yes, sir.
Fuming mad, I start back to the office to have Donovan paged so I can find out what went wrong. Halfway there, I pass some lathes, and there he is talking to Otto, the foreman. I don't know how civil the tone is. Otto appears to be dismayed by Bob's presence. I stop and stand there waiting for Bob to finish and notice me, which happens directly. Otto walks over and calls his machinists together. Bob comes over to me. You know about what's going on?
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm here.
What's the problem?
Nothing. No problem. Just standard operating procedure.
It turns out, as Bob explains to me, that the parts they were waiting for at the NCX-10 have been sitting there for about a week. Otto has been running other batches of parts. He didn't know about the importance of the parts destined for the NCX-10. To him, they looked like any other batch, and a rather unimportant one, judging from the size. When Bob got there, they were in the middle of a big, long run. Otto didn't want to stop, until Donovan explained it to him, that is.
Damn it, Al, it's just like before. They get set up, and they start running one thing, and then they have to break in the middle so we can finish something else. It's the same damn thing.
Now, hold on. Let's think about this for a second.
Well, what's there to think about?
Let's just try to reason this through. What was the problem?
The parts didn't arrive at the NCX-10, which meant the operators couldn't run the batch they were supposed to be running.
And the cause was that the bottleneck parts were held up by this non-bottleneck machine running non-bottleneck parts. Now we've got to ask ourselves why that happened.
The guy in charge here was just trying to stay busy, that's all.
Right. Because if he didn't stay busy, someone like you would come along and jump all over him.
Yeah, and if I didn't, then someone like you would jump all over me.
Okay, granted. But even though this guy was busy, he wasn't helping to move toward the goal.
Well,
he wasn't, Bob. Look, we need those parts now, not tomorrow. The non-bottleneck parts we may not need for weeks or even months. Maybe never. So by continuing to run the non-bottleneck parts, this guy was actually interfering with our ability to get an order out the door and make money.
But he didn't know any better.
Exactly. He couldn't distinguish between an important batch of parts and an unimportant one. Why not?
Well, nobody told him.
Until you came along. But you can't be everywhere. And the same kind of thing is going to happen again. So how do we communicate to everybody in the plant which parts are important?
Well, I guess we need some kind of system.
Fine. Let's go to work on one right away so we don't have to keep putting up with this crap. And before we do anything else, let's make sure the people at both of the bottlenecks know to keep working on the order with the highest priority number on the list. Bob has a final chat with Otto to make sure he knows what to do with the parts. Then the two of us head for the bottlenecks. Finally, we're walking back to the office. Glancing at Bob's face, I can tell he's still bothered by what happened. What's wrong? You look unconvinced about all this.
Al, what's going to happen if we repeatedly have people break up process runs to run parts for the bottlenecks?
We should be able to avoid idle time on the bottlenecks.
Yeah, but what's going to happen to our costs on the other 98% of the work centers we got here?
Right now, don't worry about it. Let's just keep the bottlenecks busy. Look, I'm convinced you did the right thing back there. Aren't you?
Well, maybe I did the right thing, but I had to break all the rules to do it.
Then the rules had to be broken. And maybe they weren't good rules to begin with. You know, we've always had to break up process runs for expediency to get orders shipped. The difference between then and now is that now we know to do it ahead of time, before the external pressure comes. We've got to have faith in what we know. Bob nods in agreement, but I know he'll only believe the proof. Maybe I'm the same, if I'm honest about it. A few days pass while we develop a system to cure the problem. But at 8 o'clock on Friday morning, at the beginning of first shift, I'm in the cafeteria watching the employees wander in. With me is Bob Donovan. After our earlier misunderstanding, I decided that the more people who know about the bottlenecks and how important they are, the better off we'll be. We're holding 15-minute meetings with everyone working in the plant, both foremen and hourly people. This afternoon, we'll do the same thing with people working second shift, and I'll come in late tonight to talk to the third shift as well. When we've got everybody this morning, I get up in front of them and talk. All of you know that this plant has been in a downward slide for some time. What you don't know is that we're in the position to begin to change that. You're here in this meeting because we're introducing a new system today, a system which we think will make the plant more productive than it's been in the past. In the next few minutes, I'm going to explain briefly some of the background that made us develop this new system, and then Bob Donovan is going to tell you how it works. Trying to keep meetings to 15 minutes doesn't give us the time to tell them very much. But using the analogy of an hourglass, I do explain briefly about the bottlenecks and why we have to give priority to parts on the heat treat and NCX-10 routings. For the things I can't take time to tell them, there is going to be a newsletter which will replace the old plant employee paper and which will report developments in progress in the plant. Anyway, I turn over the microphone to Donovan, and he tells them how we're going to prioritize all materials in the plant so everybody knows what to work on.
Okay, by the end of today, all work in process on the floor will be marked by a tag with a number on it. Now, the tag will be one of two colors, red or green. The red marker means the work attached to it has first priority. The red tags go on any materials needing to be processed by a bottleneck. When a batch of parts with that color marker arrives at your workstation, you're to work on them right away.
Bob explains what we mean by right away. If the employee is working on a different job, it's okay to finish what he's doing, as long as it doesn't take more than half an hour. Before an hour has passed, certainly, the red-tagged parts should be getting attention.
Okay, if you were in the middle of a setup, break the setup immediately and get ready for the red parts. When you finish the bottleneck parts, you can go back to what you were doing before. Now, the second color is green. When there is a choice between working on parts with a red marker and parts with a green marker, you work on the parts with the red marker first. So far, most of the work in process out there will be marked by green. Even so, you work on green orders only if you don't have any red ones in queue. Now, that explains the priority of the colors. But what happens when you got two batches of the same color? Each tag will have a number marked to it. You should always, always work on the materials with the lowest number.
Donovan explains some of the details and answers a couple of questions, after which I wrap it up. This meeting was my idea. I decided to take you away from your jobs, mostly because I wanted everyone to hear the same message at the same time, so that, I hope, you'll have a better understanding of what's going on. But another reason is that I know it's been a long time since most of you have heard any good news about the plant. What you've just heard about is a beginning. Even so, the future of this plant and the security of your jobs will only be assured when we start making money again. The most important thing you can do is work with us, and together we'll all be working to keep this plant working. Late that afternoon, my phone rings.
Hi, this is O'Donnell. Go ahead with the new policy on lunch and coffee breaks. We won't challenge it.
I relay the news to Donovan, and with these small victories, the week ends. At 7:29 on Saturday evening, I park the washed, waxed, buffed, and vacuumed Buick in the Barnett driveway. I reach for the bouquet of flowers beside me on the seat and step out onto the lawn wearing my new courting duds. At 7:30, I ring the doorbell. Julie opens the door.
Well, don't you look nice?
So do you, and she does. There are a few stiff minutes spent talking with her parents. Mr. Barnett asks how everything is going at the plant. I tell him it looks like we may be on our way to a recovery, and mention the new priority system and what it will do for the NCX-10 and heat treat. Both of her parents look at me blankly.
Shall we go?
I'll have her home by 10 o'clock, Mrs. Barnett.
Good. We'll be waiting.